evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, November 6th, 2018. A senior UN official says peace is important for South Sudanese children.
The fear I have is that the amount of children that will be released in the next few months are such that UNICEF and partners will not have enough resources to handle the reintegration at one go.
And women activists push for more female representation in the South Sudan peace process.
So we are here to celebrate this, but also to make sure that it is implemented properly, and also to make sure that women are part and parcel of the implementation.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Special Representative of the UN Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflicts say a chief benefit of peace in South Sudan is the likelihood that a great many child soldiers will be freed and reintegrated into their communities. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN Special Representative Virginia Gamba was present during the Khartoum peace process in South Sudan 3 weeks ago. She met with government officials and members of the various warring factions. She visited the camps where she met and talked with child soldiers. All of this, she says, has convinced her that prospects for the separation and release of children are very high. So far this year, she says 900 child soldiers have been freed. If the peace holds, she says it is possible as many as 1,000 more children will be released by the end of the year. Once they are released, she says they must go through a process of integration, and that, she notes, could be problematic.
The fear I have is that the amount of children that will be released in the next few months are such that UNICEF and partners will not have enough resources to handle the reintegration at one go, which means a lot of children are punished by staying in the bush without the chance of reintegration until we have the capacity to absorb them.
Gamba is appealing to the international community to provide aid agencies with the money they need to reintegrate the child soldiers into their communities so they can be given a fresh start. She says recruitment as soldiers is only one of the many violations to which children are subjected. She says acts of violence against children in South Sudan are the worst she has ever seen, including in Afghanistan and Syria. She says gross violations include decapitation, the use of sexual violence against very small children as a weapon of war, abductions, and the forced use of children to support the war effort. She says all of the warring parties, government and rebel forces alike, are guilty of these crimes and must be held accountable for them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Women from the Great Lakes and the Horn of Africa visiting Juba this week are calling on the government to include the opposition in the national dialogue and other conferences across the country. The women leaders say while they are glad the peace agreement is gaining momentum, South Sudanese leaders must also allow more women to take part in the process. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
Women from the Faith Mediators Network from the East African and the Great Lakes regions met with members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee and other national officials to push for more women representation as the country moves toward a new transitional government. Ugandan Betty Bigombe, who chairs the group, says she realizes the revitalized peace agreement is not perfect, but says South Sudanese should embrace it in order to achieve peace.
There's skepticism, but it's up to you, us, and everybody in the region to make sure that it succeeds, to make sure that we shame those who are skeptical about the agreement. We make sure that we assure also our people, because it's not just the international community that is skeptical about the agreement, but our own people are also skeptical because they have not understood the agreement. And I do hope that in your next move also to help government to translate, to make people understand what the agreement is all about, so that they own it, buy it, and make it their own.
Bigombe says women must be allowed to fully participate in implementing the agreement and governing the country at all levels.
This peace is not just for South Sudan. This peace for all of us in the region. It goes beyond the Great Lakes region. It goes beyond East Africa. The war in South Sudan has affected us economically, socially, and security-wise. So we are here to celebrate this, but also to make sure that it is implemented properly, and also to make sure that women are part and parcel of the implementation.
The National Dialogue Steering Committee says the 6 months consultations it conducted across South Sudan culminated in its draft report entitled The People Have Spoken. Angelo Beda, co-chair of the committee, says their report was shared with President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar.
The implication of this statement is great, that all this time the politicians, the intellectuals, the elite are those who do things and just tell the people at the grassroots to follow.
Beda says the report brought to light what ordinary people are going through, something he says had not been addressed in the revitalized peace agreement.
Not even 20% of the problems people are facing, like the proliferation of arms in southern Sudan. How will you get rid of it? This agreement does not touch it. The question of cattle and the farmers, they have not touched it. The question of corruption, roads, the money which was there has never gone, and our roads are completely in the worst part.
Beda says some South Sudanese said they were frustrated with the lack of progress by the country's leadership and called for President Kiir to step down, while others said the leaders had misused the country's resources and dragged the country into poverty. Beda says the dialogue committee will conduct regional conferences beginning early next year. He's calling on the SPLM-AIO and other opposition parties to participate in the dialogue. For VOA News, I am Dingo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Some residents of Juba Town say they can no longer afford a balanced diet because of the market prices. One shopper at Juba's Custom Market says many people have given up buying meat in order to be able to buy other essential goods. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
Here in Juba's crowded customs market, traders and buyers are haggling over prices of everything from electronics to foodstuffs. Many buyers say all they can afford to buy are green vegetables and legumes like beans. Speaking in Arabic, Lina Gaetano says she enjoys eating cow hooves but can no longer afford it.
I came and asked the price of cow hoof legs and
I was told a kilogram is for 700 and 600. So I decided to leave it. I'll go and buy something else.
Josephine Kiden is carrying fish in a plastic bag. Kiden says she prefers fish to meat because it is healthier. Kiden says she knows most South Sudanese enjoy eating meat more than anything else. Kiden is calling on the government to do what it can to reduce meat prices across the country.
I bought some cooking oil. I saw it has reduced, and I got onions has also reduced. But the prices for the meat is the same. Yeah. So I ran into small children there, and they were buying quarter kilo because the meat is very expensive still. And South Sudanese are not vegetarian. Most of them have to buy meat on a daily basis. So if they could work on the prices of the meat, that would be good.
Juba resident Jenti Sebit says, aside from high meat prices at customs market, prices of other food commodities are rising on a daily basis. Sebit says she came to buy sugar, but did not have enough money because the price was so much higher than last week when she bought 10 kilograms of sugar for 1,600 South Sudanese pounds. Today, the same amount sells for 2,300 South Sudanese pounds. Speaking in Arabic, Sabit says she has resorted to eating green vegetables due to the high price of meat.
I eat a green vegetable because greens are cheap. For meat, if you are poor, you cannot afford. You will have to buy a half kilogram at 600,000 Sudanese pound, and you have to buy other things. It won't be enough.
Monjuak Simon, a student at the University of Juba who lives in a hostel, says she cannot afford to buy meat unless she pools her money with other students.
For me, I like greens. I'm a student, so meat maybe it's very expensive for me alone. If we do sharing, maybe it's good, but for me as a student, I prefer greens because it's okay with my income.
About 10 butchers are seated in the middle of the market waiting for buyers. Some of the butchers encourage passers-by to come and buy meat at what they call a good price. Butcher Joseph Kamis says prices of food items, including meat, will slowly fall as peace and security take hold in the country. Speaking in Arabic, he says butchermen cannot reduce their prices because of extra costs they incur by hiring armed guards to watch over the cattle they bring in from neighboring countries.
Of course, these things come from outside. We don't have anything here. Even the cows are brought from the neighboring country. But if there is peace and security, definitely the prices will reduce because automatically roads like Bor, Terkaka, Meridi, Yambio, Tambura, up to Juba will be open. Even if it was expensive some time back, a kilogram was at 1,200, but now it is £1,100.
In customs market, a kilogram of meat costs 1,100 South Sudanese pounds, down from 1,200 a few weeks ago. A fish weighing about 5 kilograms costs 1,500 South Sudanese pounds, while a live chicken costs 3,000 South Sudanese pounds. Residents say these items are too expensive compared to handfuls of green vegetables, which cost 100 South Sudanese pounds. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the benefits of exercise. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
have you ever lent money to a friend who did not pay back? How did you handle that situation?
They never return, and I also give up because I want to maintain the friendship. Because our friendship was not monetary. It is a social friendship that it was not meant to involve in economics.
Very often than not, yes. But most of the times, if a friend asks me to lend them money, I would only give it to them if I'm willing to give it to them. Otherwise, if I'm not willing to give them that amount of money, I'll tell them I don't have it.
Actually, it has happened, but it's not very easy to borrow someone who is not your friend. So someone who is my friend, I decide we remain friends, but not on money issues.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about men's health when their wives are expecting. Many people know that a woman's health, including her diet and exercise habits, can impact the health of their baby even before she gets pregnant. Many women try to reduce excessive weight and check with their doctors to optimize their health. But until recently, little was known about the role a father's diet and exercise choices might play. VOA's Carol Payson reports on a study that shows, just like for women, there is a link between father's health and that of his unborn children.
Just like that, okay?
Matthew Hurt is teaching his young sons how to hit a baseball. He wants them to enjoy sports and exercising.
I want it to be just natural for them. I don't want it to be a chore, right? I want them to just want to go outside, want to be active, and enjoy life to its fullest.
A study at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center looked at the impact of fathers' exercise habits on their offspring. Kristen Stanford is a member of Ohio State's Diabetes and Metabolism Research Center. She co-led the study. The results showed that even moderate exercise before a baby was conceived
resulted in improved metabolic health in their adult offspring. So essentially it improved their glucose metabolism, decreased body weight, and increased their insulin sensitivity.
The World Health Organization says one in four adults worldwide are dangerously inactive. That increases the risk of obesity, high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, cancer, and diabetes. Inactivity also has social and economic consequences. The research at Ohio State was done in mice. More work needs to be done to see if it applies to people as well.
The idea would be that if you have a dad who wants to have a child, if they could exercise maybe just the month prior to conception, that would have a really dramatic effect on their child's life.
The researchers also found that exercise helped even with a poor diet. Sedentary mice fed a high-fat diet passed along negative health issues like obesity and insulin resistance. But those effects were completely reversed by exercise.
A high-fat diet, even a mild high-fat diet, in this case it was only 3 weeks, changed the profile, but exercise kind of restored it back to normal.
More work needs to be done to see if the same applies to humans. But in the animal studies, exercise for the male mouse was key to the health of his offspring. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
A rebel spokesman released from prison last week by a presidential pardon says he was never tortured in prison. James Gadet Dak, Riek Machar's former spokesman, says the most difficult part of his imprisonment was not having some of his human rights. He says he is happy to be a free man once again and will be traveling soon to see his family overseas.
I think, you know, how happy a person would be if he has been in freedom after 2 years. And this is what I feel right now, that I'm free again, that I can walk around, that I can also talk to my friends.
How about your family? You have not been together with them for quite a long time.
We have been talking on the phone. And this is one of the things I said, my priority is to see my family and my friends.
I know it's not easy to look back, but most people who are our listeners would want to hear about how you were arrested and brought to Juba. What happened to you during your time in detention?
Well, I was arrested on the 2nd of November in my house in Nairobi. Not told that I was being arrested at the time, but I was taken that I was going to meet somebody. And then I ended up in Juba. And once I arrived in Juba, then I was charged. And because of the nature of my job in the opposition, that's how I came to be in detention and then taken to court.
Talk to us a little bit about your life at the Blue House. We understand you were a guest there for some time.
Yeah, you know, when you're in detention, you don't have freedom to move, and you comply with what you are told to do. And this is exactly what happened at the Blue House. I had to comply with what I was told to do as a person under detention. So, placed in a cell where I would be paraded in the morning with the rest of my colleagues who were there. But actually, I was not tortured physically. But as I said, there was no freedom to move. It took time for me to see my relatives, to visit my friends and relatives. But gradually, I was allowed to see relatives.
While you were in prison, some of your party members were busy sending messages out there that you have been tortured, you are blind, somehow even saying that you were almost killed. Now you're telling us here that you have not been tortured. Where were these stories coming from?
I was under detention. I did not have access to the media, so I do not know how these stories came about. But as I'm telling you, I was not tortured. I was just put under detention, and some of my freedoms were removed, were taken away, such as accessing my relatives and friends. But there was no torture.
And so what is your next plan? I mean, the president pardoned you, and you are now a free man. What is next? Are you going back to join your colleagues?
Well, first I want to see my family where they are now, and after seeing them for a while during this three-year period, then I may decide to come back and maybe rejoin politics. But as for now, I want to go and see my family.
That's James Gadet, former spokesman for rebel leader Riek Machar. He was speaking with me yesterday from Juba. A retired South African military officer who was sentenced to death in South Sudan and freed by a presidential pardon, says his arrest was politically motivated. Colonel William John Enley claims his trials were unfair because his key witnesses, first Vice President Taban Dengai and the Minister of Petroleum Ezekiel Lul, ignored their court summons.
So I was not locked up with my fellow political detainees for at least 6-7 months. But the routine is normally about 9 o'clock in the morning. The so-called parade takes place where everybody is individually checked off on a list. And between 1 and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that is when the notorious beans and aseda or maize porridge is dished out for the next 24 hours. And that is basically the routine. There is no facility that provides, for example, soap to wash clothes, sugar, salt, the basics. So it's just the basic food is given to keep people alive.
How many other foreigners are there in that facility that you have seen or you have heard of?
Okay, John, when I was there were a few Sudanese citizens. There was a Ugandan. And there was a Danish guy and a couple of Americans. The Americans were not there for a long time. The Danish gentleman was there for about 2 months, also with a passport issue. He lost his passport way back in 2013, so he was kept there for a couple of months and then deported. But not many foreigners at all. Oh, a couple of Eritreans were brought in every now and again, and one or two Chinese people.
How did you react when you heard the news about your release? How was your initial reaction?
John, it's been a build-up over time. And what I came to realize was the fact that I waited 18 months before I even went to the court. That it was a politically appointed court, with a politically biased-based set of charges. And at the end of the day, I realized a political trial, political sentence, and it would be resolved by a political solution. The only problem is I didn't know how long that political solution would take.
The charges brought against you were that you were spying, you were planning to overthrow President Kiir. Were you given an opportunity to defend yourself in court?
Not at all, John. I did have a chance to do my own statement and address the court, but not one of my witnesses who I wanted there, and the witnesses who I asked to be subpoenaed was the Taban Dengai, Ezekiel Gatkuth, Yin Lom, obviously the two ministers who not one of them arrived there. So, you know, to get the case involved in court, we were told that we are playing for time after I'd been 18 months without appearing in front of the court. And that was it, you know, a week later, finding and sentencing. And the other strange thing, I was informed 2 weeks before the end of the trial that I would be leaving to go to Juba Central Prison to serve out my sentence. And it was quite strange to me because I had not even been found guilty, not even been sentenced at that point in time.
And now that you mentioned Juba Central Prison, could you tell us how life is in Central Prison compared to the national security?
John, it's almost like night and day. And I'm actually glad you're asking this question. Firstly, I would like to thank the personnel and the management of the prison system. You know, with the facilities and the resources available to them, they treated both myself and James Cadet with great respect, and it was reciprocated, but much more open, much more accommodating. And the same with my fellow inmates who were on death row. They took very, very good care of me. You know, exercise was possible. The food was the same, but my visitors were allowed to come see me when they could, which was basically once a week. Now, in comparison with the once a month in national security after 7 months, and that was only the embassy allowed to come, or representatives from the embassy allowed to come see me. But in comparison, I came out, picked up the 20 kilos that I lost in national security. So I returned back to South Africa much better, much healthier, and much more confident, you know, in the system in South Sudan after my time in the central prison.
And have you made friends in the central prison? If there's any message you would like to give to your friends back at the Juba Central Prison, what would that message be, given your positive experience there?
But I would like to thank my fellow inmates at that time for their honesty towards me, their openness, and the fact that the courage that they show by being ready to wait no matter how long the system takes, and the hope that is there for all of them to be released, hopefully pardoned or settled with their complainants in the same manner in which my case was resolved. So I would like to thank them and the prison personnel for everything that they did to me, for me. And basically all of them have become very special in my life. And
That's Colonel William John Enley, a retired South African military officer who had been sentenced to death in South Sudan before being freed by a presidential pardon last week. He was speaking with me from Johannesburg yesterday. Some South Sudanese refugees in Palabek refugee settlement in Uganda's northern district of Lamwa said they would like to return home now that the revitalized peace agreement has been signed, but others say they will only return once they are sure South Sudan's leaders are fully implementing the peace deal. Onen Walter Solomon visited the camp recently and has this report from Gulu.
32-year-old Ochan Robert says he has lived as a refugee twice. The first time was in 1989, when he was just 3 years old. Robert says after living in Uganda as a refugee for 16 years, he returned to his country. But the conflict that broke out in 2013 and the renewed fighting in 2016 forced him to flee his home again. He says before conflict spread to his village in 2013, he had planted banana trees, started a poultry business, and built a house that he was able to live in for just 1 week. He fled when government forces attacked and destroyed his village in Pajok while chasing rebels.
I'm here starting life again from zero. So when I follow my own personal life, and when I follow the train of the peace that have been signed in South Sudan and violated, it makes me cautious when it comes to making decision to going back. Yes, I'm a South Sudanese, I'll remain a South Sudanese, you cannot rule that out.
Margaret Aloyo, who fled South Sudan in 2016, says when she was home, she worked to pay for her children's school fees and buy their school uniforms, but she cannot find work now.
For me, I'm feeling going back even though it's said tomorrow, because it is my real country. It is my own home, own motherland. I'm willing to go. From there, I have a work to do, and also I get a payment when I'm working. Here, we don't have any work to do. Even though you have a NAP paper, you cannot get any work. We are not sending our children to university without money.
Robert says whether or not refugees like her return to their country soon depends on if the government and the opposition quickly disarm and demobilize civilians and can turn their forces in specific areas as stipulated in the agreement.
We'll wait for the rebels to be cantoned and the soldiers reintegrated, and then a national army form. When they are taken to the barracks and then the villages are free, we wait for the tripartite agreement where the government of South Sudan, the government of Uganda and UNHCR will sign to allow us to begin to voluntarily move back.
Another refugee who prefers to identify himself only as Sedit for fear of retaliation is urging the government and the armed opposition to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement to encourage refugees return to their country.
For us, refugee, it is not that we don't want to go back home. I'm saying if there is permanent peace, I can go back. But if there is not, those incidents that has happened, seeing people being killed, shot, people cut with pangas, I don't want to see it. That's why I have that little hope that I will go when there is permanent peace. It is not that I'm a rebel when I'm staying here.
Robert says his prayer is that peace ceremonies make South Sudanese leaders predictable and accountable. He also says he believes that elections will determine in the country's future. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Gulu, northern Uganda.
That's our show for this Tuesday. I am John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you allowed us into your homes and vehicles. If you like to leave a comment about this show, our email is southsudan@voanews.com. If you're planning to be out of Juba where there are no VOA FM stations, you can still listen to us. Our frequencies are 11850 kHz, 13865 kHz, and 15180 kHz. Join us back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Africa, Africa, yako. Yeah,